Welcome to the September podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Charles. The September issue is on the topic of advancements in the management of epilepsy, and the topic editor is Dr. James Rutker. In this podcast, Dr. Rutker will be speaking with Dr. Gregory Worrell, epileptologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, about his phase 1 trial of a hybrid array system for intracranial electroencephalography.
Well, why don't you briefly review why this came about, what the advantages are of this hybrid grid system that you have, and how it may help us in the future garner more information about patients who have epilepsy amenable to surgery?
It really, I think, goes back to just the fundamental questions that we always ask in patients with intractable epilepsy. And historically, that's primarily been localization, so spatial localization. And temporal localization tied to that, in that we like to see when the seizure first starts, as it may be more localized there and where it actually begins. And then with recent developments with the investigational devices for stimulation, in particular the ongoing clinical trial by NeuroPace that first detects the onset of a seizure and then stimulates to try and abort it, it really brought home this issue of the importance of not only spatial localization, but temporal localization. Mm-hmm. Because we think that the sooner that you could identify the onset of the seizure, it would seem reasonable, at least intuitive, that stimulating early rather than late, you would have more chance of disrupting this process of ictogenesis, or the development of a seizure. So that was really the jumping off point, asking what's involved in localization, in particular neocortical epilepsy, but it also applies to hippocampal epilepsy. And the idea of temporal localization in addition to spatial localization. Mm-hmm. And when we looked at how we do that currently, and this is true of implanted grids for evaluation for epilepsy surgery, as well as for the first generation brain stimulation device, they use the technology, or the brain machine interface is, I think, the fancy way of saying it, is that we use these roughly 4 millimeter diameter electrodes that are spaced a centimeter apart. The spatial and temporal localization of the onset of seizures is the critical question that we're always faced with for epilepsy surgery and for the first generation neurostimulation devices. Mm-hmm. And how we do that, when we began to think about this, it was clear that the brain machine interface that's currently used for surgical evaluation and in the NeuroPace investigational device in particular that's already out there being used is this somewhat antiquated interface, in that it's a 4 millimeter contact electrodes that are spaced a centimeter apart. And where that came from, I think this has more to do with legacy than electrophysiology. Mm-hmm. Because if we look at how the brain is organized, the primary functional unit of the brain is, as we step up from a neuron, would then be a cortical column. And the size of a cortical column roughly be, 300 to 700 microns. So the idea of when a seizure first begins, how you might detect that, it would make sense that you might want to do that on a spatial scale that would allow you to sample the brain on the spatial scale of the fundamental organization of the brain, as opposed to a 4 millimeter contact with centimeter spacing. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of the idea, and we began recording. And as we accumulated data, some of the results were pretty striking, actually. We've just recently published in Brain some of the early interictal findings, and in medial temporal lobe, examined recording broadband. So there's the spatial aspect of it, mm-hmm. recording over what more sort of submillimeter domain sampling of space by using hybrid or grids of microwires that are closely spaced at a millimeter or a half millimeter. And then the temporal sampling of that signal, what historically has been done is people usually record from, say, 0.5 hertz out to about 100 hertz. Those numbers as well are largely determined by legacy more than electrophysiology because we know that brain activity, brain's capable of generating activity from ultra-slow oscillations and even DC changes out to hundreds of hertz. And that kind of activity is really not received a great deal of attention, but is receiving more attention now. So when we first started recording with these, we developed this hybrid grid system and began recording what I kind of jokingly we call DC to daylight. So we just, without filtering, and sample at 32,000 hertz, and we can just record across the whole spectrum of what the brain can generate. And with these, the microwire, 40 micron wire contacts, we see activity up in the ripple and fast ripple range that's up to as much as 700 hertz. So this activity is not captured by standard clinical EEG.
Well, that's great. So in essence, you've probably more than doubled the readings that you can do from the surface based on the placement of the electrodes and bringing them closer together and adding more information. I was just wondering whether there's a limit to this technology. Can you even decrease that electrode distance more? And at one point, does it become very difficult then to analyze the huge amount of data points you would be getting from even smaller electrode contacts that might be maybe 1 or 2 millimeters apart? Do you have any comments about further increasing the technology for the benefit of capturing more data from the surface of the brain?
Yes, that's this was a bit of a technical challenge actually. And when we first started recording, we were capturing 128 channels, and it would be basically a mixture of the hybrid grids have the clinical macros and the micros, and then we would record those broadband. So 128 channels sampling at, let's say, 10,000 hertz if we want to look at, or say 5,000 hertz because we want to look at activity up to 1,000 hertz, really generates a huge stream of data. And so this became a technical stumbling block, but it turns out that technology for recording or for storing data has just, as you know, has really exploded.
Right.
So currently our acquisition system generates just about a terabyte of data a day, and we'll record up to 320 channels. We'll stream those 320 channels over the hospital backbone, which is a fiber, dedicated fiber channel backbone, to the lab, and then we have a massive storage warehouse or library that's currently 70 terabytes. But all of that is really off-the-shelf technology. It's can be expensive, but it can all be purchased. And I think that this is technology that will continue to grow, and obviously, and so that's been less of a limitation. But it did take some time to get everything up and going. And I think that question of what is the ultimate spatial resolution, of course it depends on the question that we want to ask, but we've really focused on this question, and there's some older literature on this about how does a seizure begin? Does it begin in a submillimeter volume, or does it begin in a multifocal volume? And that is just beginning to, we think, reveal itself. And one of the findings that we have that we haven't published yet, but we're really excited about, we have reported it at meetings, the American Epilepsy Society meeting last year, is that we record submillimeter domain seizures, and we've just been calling them micro seizures. And so these are actually interictal events. The patient doesn't have any physical manifestations. So they're they're subclinical seizures, but they're not even detected on the macro electrodes. So we have these micro electrodes, 40 micron wires that are positioned around the macro electrode,
mm-hmm.
and we record multifocal seizure activity from the micro wires. But wires that are even a millimeter away, we may not even see activity, and we won't see, often don't see activity on the macro electrodes. So this, I think, is very interesting in that it demonstrates that there are submillimeter domain seizure activity going on, little sparks and seizures, little events happening in small regions of brain that can be multifocal within mm-hmm. the epileptogenic zone.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting finding. Yeah.
You know, there's a criticism about subdural recordings on the cortical surface that while they may be excellent at capturing data that reside beneath the cortex
mm-hmm.
By a few millimeters. What do you do about an epileptogenic focus that is actually quite deep, and this might refer to, for example, the medial temporal lobe or other subcortical gray areas that might be associated with, for example, cortical dysplasia, where the placement of depth electrodes might provide information that would be extremely important. I'm wondering if your technology that you've described with this hybrid grid could also be applied, do you think, to depth electrodes?
And the answer is yes, and thanks for asking. And we've over the last year and a half as well, been recording from hybrid depth electrodes. And the results that we recently published in the journal Brain, were all from depth electrodes. And it's analogous in that we take the starting off point is the clinical depth electrode. Those are the typical electrodes we use are 2.3 millimeter length and then a millimeter diameter, the collars that are on the millimeter diameter depth electrode. And then in between those macro contacts or the clinical contacts, we've inserted micro wire electrodes. And the results are basically the same as we talked about, that
mm-hmm.
There's very high frequency activity up in the ripple and fast ripple range. And
mm-hmm.
and that was first described in humans by Bragan and Engel at UCLA, using micro wires that protrude out from the tip. So we use those as well and have added micro electrodes along the shaft of the electrode. So that allows us to address deeper structures
mm-hmm.
in the medial temporal lobe. I think one of the big challenges, as I see it, is still the foci that are in the sulcus, as you described.
Yes.
You know, with the grid on the surface, you primarily record from the crowns.
Yes.
And let's say if a patient has essentially a normal MRI, it's quite easy to cover quite a bit of the hemisphere even with a grid, but to go fishing, if you would,
right.
Will, the sulci, it's just, this is a problem that hasn't been solved. Well recognized, but it remains open, I think.
Oh, thanks, Doctor. Well, I mean, my last question to you relates to where do we go from here, and what are the clinical applications? You mentioned some trials that are ongoing. When will this technology be fully accessible to North American neurosurgeons and epileptologists who are embarking on this type of invasive monitoring? Can you speak to the issue of future applications?
Yes, and I guess in first, we felt that the one of the first steps was the issue of safety. There are more cables, there are more electrodes, and currently there's not a proven benefit. So that was the primary motivation of the paper for your journal
mm-hmm.
to give our initial experience just in terms of safety. And we haven't had additional problems
mm-hmm.
when we compare to our previous experience with standard clinical subdural grids.
Mm-hmm.
We get the same information plus all of the information from the micro wires and the broadband recording. And we haven't found that there's an increased risk of infection or other complications such as stroke or hemorrhage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're comfortable with that. And in fact, the two vendors that are producing the electrodes that we've used, AdTech and PMT, mm-hmm. Vendors that all, you know, people will be familiar with, mm-hmm. are supplying these electrodes to other centers already.
Oh, good.
So those capabilities are out there. I think there's the infrastructure issue that's solvable but is substantial to record mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. these kinds of grids. And then I think where we are pushing at this point is, can we anticipate the onset of a seizure? So are there signatures, these micro-seizure events, fast ripple events that are precursor events that are harbingers of larger scale seizures, and also the process of ictogenesis? How does that large scale seizure actually happen? What are the earliest, very earliest events? And we think, of course, that's a fundamental interest just in terms of basic understanding of ictogenesis, but should have impact on how we abort seizures, for instance, with stimulation. And I think the idea of responsive stimulation detection and then stimulation could be very important there.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Worrell, for your excellent contribution to Neurosurgical Focus and for participating in this podcast today. This information, I think, will be extremely important and valuable for our listeners who are involved in epilepsy neurosurgery, and your contribution is timely, and we look forward to future applications.
This concludes our podcast for the September issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the October issue, when the topic will be traumatic brain injury. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.